the government budget is like $6.2 trillion now. If you take the average income and multiply it by the number of people who are working, it's only about $6 trillion. In fact, it's a little bit less. The government is more than half of the economy. They control everything. You would never get away with a 60% tax on everybody. Mm-mm. What this new battleground is showing is that in the Bitcoin world, within the Bitcoin environment, they're going to have to samurai wallet every one of us to get that money, which means it's not going to work.
It's not enforceable.
There's either going to be a revolution or society goes from a quiet fraud of 60% of our wealth to guns and whips stealing 60% of our wealth. That second one is not sustainable. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. This is Bitcoin Audible, and I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we are diving into, this is another conversation I had on a different show. This is with Sam Callahan, really awesome guy. It's on the Swan Signal podcast. We talked a ton about Nostr and these new peer-to-peer and kind of distributed protocols and how they play a role. Where AI is going to fit into all of this as we're moving into this future, how Bitcoin is essentially tied as the underlying communication layer, the language for all of these different tools and technologies, like why it's the perfect money for AI, especially agentic AI that like we issue as agents to go out and complete tasks or do things for us. And then even the increasing political relevance of Bitcoin, which is funny because this actually occurred before Trump and everyone and everything that happened at Bitcoin 2024 and the flood of Bitcoin into the political stage, which is funny. So this might be really interesting to listen to just because it was just before all of that and to compare that perspective with what just happened in the last few weeks. And we also bring up Hedgehog, which I know I've talked about on this show, but I really just find this a really undervalued, and I'm hoping that development moves forward because Super Testnet has built his working version and now he's moved on to other projects, and I want to keep that alive. So it's a good time to actually bring that up as well, since we discussed that. I think that's a really, really potent tool that we should absolutely be implementing and utilizing. So with that, a shout out to CoinKite for supporting the show. Shout out to everybody on Fountain who sends me boosts and sends me a message. Vake, what's up? Matlif, Michael, what's up, man? Clarkian, I see all you guys. I see the boosts, and I really appreciate the support and the comments. And with that, don't forget to check out Fountain. If you didn't know that you could actually get paid sats for listening to the show, it's actually a really fantastic way to do it because I can actually send out a promotion that I pay to get the show. Like, you want to listen to the show and you actually get streamed sats to listen to my show, and then vice versa, people can stream sats to donate to my show. It's just a fantastic platform, and it's such a cool implementation of Lightning. And then when you get those sats, when you stack those sats, what are you going to do? You're going to send them to your cold card, and you're going to get your cold card with the discount code Bitcoin Audible because you like discounts and you like Guy Swan and you want to support this show. But don't forget to check that out. That's how you keep your Bitcoin safe, and the link and details are all right in the show notes. With that, let's get into today's discussion with Sam Callahan on the Swan Signal podcast, all about Bitcoin and the intersection with AI.
We got a recurring guest on right now. It's Guy Swan. Guy is somebody who I've looked up to for a long time. He's been in this space for pretty much longer than anybody. They say that Guy has read more about Bitcoin than anybody. He's a Bitcoin educator. He is an entrepreneur. I want to welcome back on the show Guy Swan. We got a lot to talk about. So Guy, welcome to the show.
What is up, man? Good to be here.
What's up? Man, it's been a while. I feel like last time you were on the show, Last time you were on the show, we really talked a lot about AI because it was just getting like really gaining traction. Like I think ChatGPT just came out, and it's just crazy to see how fast that whole space has developed. You know, it's kind of like that exponential growth. And we talked about how Bitcoin is just like the perfect money for AI. It's like the AI money. And so let's start there. Like, what are some of your takeaways? Yeah, I know you can like kind of keep track of that, those developments pretty closely. Has any of your ideas changed? How are you viewing AI and its kind of relation with Bitcoin and vice versa?
Yeah. I don't know if any of my views have really changed. It's interesting to watch the kind of the development play out like in the two different directions, because closed source and kind of centralized models have not the models themselves, but like the kind of business models have done, they have taken the trophy on implementation, and they have like aggressively pushed for all of the kind of promise of AI really, really well. Whereas the open source environment is vastly wider and like more broad, but very piecemeal, which makes very sense. It makes a lot of sense when you think about it from how open source develops and how you've got a community of people building individual tools. Like a lot of the things that I can do, I have AI running on my Linux right now, and it's just a whole bunch of open source. Just collects, it creates an environment to install. They just have like little packages to, essentially it's a simplified like Docker container for each AI thing, so that you don't have to worry about prerequisites and, you know, do I have this other application that it's dependent on? And you can just kind of click and install all of them. And there's so many cool things. There's like one of them that I can like change my face live in a video. Like it's a little bit clunky, but like I put as a joke, because I was like working on like some meme ideas, like while I was sitting in bed, I put Selma Hayek's face on me because I was doing the Hayek quote thing where we quote F.A. Hayek, but put Selma Hayek on it, and I put Selma Hayek's face on it, but it didn't recognize the beard. So like the beard was like under Selma Hayek's face. And like I showed it to my wife while I was sitting there with like the FaceTime, and she was like, don't ever show that shit to me again. That is hideous. but like it's crazy like the number of things you can do, whereas the centralized like sort of more like profit-based like corporate tools have been like all-encompassing, and in the same sense they have all of the horrific privacy problems that you would expect. Is they essentially are just looking at all of your data, like all of it in a pure semantic sense. So they can get summaries of your data, and they could literally ask, like ChatGPT, with all the information you can give it, they could literally go to each user and be like, what's this user's political opinion? And then it could just summarize the political views of each of the users, but just based on your information. It's crazy what they can do with this from the other side as like a surveillance tool. But at the same time, ChatGPT or GPT-4o, which just released, is not only a new model, but it's a more efficient model. They're working on, and this is something that we've seen pretty aggressively throughout the space, is recognizing quality over quantity is way more valuable. Is that, you know, you can, it doesn't matter whether you're like, everybody was boasting like, oh, I got 100 billion parameter model, I have a trillion parameter model. But it's like, if you just feed it more junk, you're just going to get a shittier model. Like, so you'll just spend an exorbitant amount of money and you'll have worse results, because as the saying, it's always true, garbage in, garbage out. This same thing's true for models. So GPT-4o is actually more efficient and has better results. So it's actually a smaller model and requires less compute, but has actually increased the scoring, the benchmark on a lot of the statistics or a lot of the different tests. Whereas I think there's like one or two that it it downgraded or whatever, just because of the size. But the really cool thing is that obviously this is on top of the fact that in implementation, you talk to it. Like you can just turn it in voice mode and it will talk back to you. And it literally sounds like a human. Like it sounds more human than most support people that
sounded
I talked
like
to.
Scarlett Johansson
a little bit. Her good movie. Yeah, so the implementation of that and like the number of layers, because you have to have a, you know, text to speech, or excuse me, speech to text, then transcription, then you have to be able to make sure that that's accurate enough, and probably running that through at least a light LLM to make any corrections, and then putting that into the essentially a live prompt with some sort of prompt engineering so that the model knows how to respond like you're in a conversation. Because, you know, if you don't give it that, it's just going to trying to guess the next thing that you're going to say, and then turn that around and produce a result, and then give it to a very high quality text to speech model that knows emotional inference and is probably trying to calculate your emotional state from what you're saying in order to alter how its emotional response is. So there's like layers of stuff going on here, which is really insane. And then also has vision implemented, and this is all like last week, by the way. Like, you know, Google I/O just released a whole bunch of new things, and then GPT-4o just kind of overshadowed them again, as they've kind of done multiple times now. But like the stack of stuff that is working together to create that experience is kind of wild. Even with all of the huge drawbacks of you know, the centralized surveillance and all of the problems that come with a centralized entity. And what's funny is that we were actually going to do Devs Who Can't Code this morning. The series that we have where we just build stuff with AI. And I work with my developer and I try to figure out what I can build, and he just tells me where it sucks and where it's useful. You know, he kind of guides the situation. It's a really fun series that we've got a whole bunch of like really cool plans for, but we've been generally using ChatGPT because it just has the best responses. And the one that I have on my computer has a couple of limitations, and I've had issues with it, mostly because of the interface, not the model itself. But so we'd just been using ChatGPT, and ChatGPT was down today. So it was like, ah, well, crap. Like they had like a big hiccup. So another point of issue of relying on some sort of a trusted third party with all of this. Mm-hmm. But there's something really interesting, and because it's super relevant to Bitcoin and everything that's going on, is about the privacy problem. And something I've noticed is that I think the privacy problem is becoming a lot more relevant in the age of AI, and people are becoming more aware of it. And I think part of the reason why is actually because we're able to anthropomorphize, we're able to personify our computers now. Is that, you know, when your computer is just a box, and, you know, like the spying on you is some code and some terminal window, you're like, I don't know. You don't really know how to relate to that as like a normal person. You know, if you're not a hacker or a developer, you don't really know the scope of what is being lost. Like the privacy issue isn't really, you can't feel the privacy issue.
It's not tangible.
But as the devices themselves start to act more like people, and they respond to what we say, and we literally have a dialogue with them, suddenly that feeling of somebody is watching me becomes far more prevalent, whether we want it to or not, because now it's this thing that we're interacting with. When you personify it, now you have the social weight of somebody seeing me naked, kind of thing. And I think that's actually a really interesting new dynamic to the privacy problem with these things. And there's one that I haven't really dug into in depth, but a company called Nova AI, which is actually trying to build custom implementations, which will be really interesting to watch the development in the open source space go this way. But custom implementations of a bunch of open source self-hosted tools for businesses. So that, how do you get that sort of experience with GPT-4o, with ChatGPT, like with this easy centralized, all of my data can be seen, but how do you do it so that your data never leaves your servers? And a lot of people are becoming far more aware of just how big of a problem that is. And I think it'll be an uphill battle, along with all of the aggressive adoption of all the Google Docs and, you know, Ask My Docs and Ask My Photos things. At the exact same time, I think there will be a very interesting separation of the markets, so to speak, as this side and this corner starts to realize just how vast and awful the consequences of only going in this direction really is. So yeah, it's been wild. It's been wild. I've never had a shortage of things to talk about on AI Unchained.
Well, you brought up like the privacy problem. And I think that's a great point. I mean, it is going to be much more tangible when you feel like some kind of AI is watching you. And then in the end, you know, it's a centralized, you know, controlled AI, you know, controlled by some entity. And it's kind of scary to think that they can kind of dictate how you think and what you think is real facts versus what's not true, what is true. Even like change how you're feeling. It's just like a wild concept to me to think about. And like, so how does like the architecture of the internet change, do you think, with the introduction of AI? And to me, I always think about Bitcoin. I always say like Bitcoin's immutability is going to shine with time, because it's the only thing in like the digital, like cyberspace, that is like unmanipulatable. Like it doesn't change. And you can trust it. It's like called the truth machine. And I think even AI will make that shine even more, because like the idea of how quickly misinformation can spread and how they can kind of tell people what to think. What are your thoughts on that? Is like Bitcoin's immutability in the age of AI and how it can kind of change the architecture of the internet and how the two kind of coalesce with one another?
I completely agree with the concept of Bitcoin as this immutable center, so to speak, because without a doubt, I think the internet is, you can analogize or metaphor the internet as a wild and incredibly aggressive ocean, you know, just like everything is in movement, like it is all fluid, nothing is static. You know, you might have respites of a boat here and there, but for the most part it's all just this big wild open uncontrolled space. And Bitcoin is essentially like a vast mountain made of just pure solid rock or diamond or something, just an impenetrable thing to latch your, you know, to dock your boat to build anything off of. And I think AI, not only will AI change the architecture of the internet, because there's two different things that AI does, is one is basically AI will be needed to navigate a world of AI. And in the world with AI, if you don't have AI to navigate it, you're lost. Because AI is generative. Like, there was an article that I read, which I don't totally agree with the entire premise, but it's about this really vicious and creepy creating of kids shows entirely with AI. And they are so like uncanny valley, like creepy, like I would never want Rad watching that stuff. Like it just like, and it's so weird too, because like as someone watching content, you so desperately want it to have some sort of a meaning. You're trying so hard to pull something out of the interaction. And even if you know it's going nowhere, that there's no actual thread, there's like, it's incoherent at, you know, 75% of the way through the story as a story. There's not even really a story. It's 75% of the way through the video. It really has nothing to do with what happened at the beginning. There are interactions that are so creepy and make absolutely no sense. And but you're so desperately still trying to pull some sort of a meaning out of it. It's really, really weird. But it's a fantastic article. And he refers to the enshittification of the internet, is that these things are automated. Like these YouTube things just like name themselves like, oh, learn colors with kids. And they're targeted specifically toward kids. And then they label them, you know, for 30 minutes. And so parents will literally search for these things and be like, how do I get my kid? How do I busy my kid for 30 minutes so that I can wash, you know, do the dishes or the laundry or something and just get him out of my hair? And so they sit him down in front of this thing and he's watching this like creepy, probably like brain rotting nonsense. And there's literally like a million subscribers. Like just like unbelievable amounts of views on this awful, awful stuff. And not a single human in the production room has even watched this thing to just see what it did. Wow. Like they just, the whole thing, the whole stack is AI, generative AI, awful. And I love the term the enshittification of the internet just because it's funny. But the flood of just being able to do that, like we are entering a phase where information is so vastly, I mean, we've already been there, but it just got an exponent on it essentially, is the ability to generate information is so cheap and so easy. Video content, imagery, summaries, documents, newsletters, the ability to discern something fake from something that a human actually output, that we don't really have a strong filter for. We don't really have it anymore. It just, it's all just kind of like melding together, which means that we need a new way to weigh, we need a new way, W-A-Y, to weigh, W-E-I-G-H, information on the internet. We can't just use clicks. We can't just use links. Like the Google model for search doesn't work anymore. We need semantics. We need understanding of our filter. We need, and I think what we really need is a way to weigh things via our social graph. This is where I think social media as a protocol is actually a necessary next step for actually solving a ton of the major problems on the internet. That was a really great, concept of this application, and I've seen it in practice a number of times with Noster, and it's a perfect way to start kind of building out. And I don't know if it's going to be Noster specifically, but whatever it is, we need a social media protocol where I can judge the relevance and value of things that I see, whether it's reviews, whether it's products, whether it's locations or things that I want to do, that I can judge those things through their connection to my social graph. Because in that world, generative AI and like a million bots are of no meaning to me if the people that I follow aren't interacting or following or care about the bots. If they hide the bot, well, then even better. Then I'm automatically hiding them by default. Like I'm using my social graph to filter out and find what is actually signal in essentially a limitless landscape of noise. And then to be able to connect payments to this, to be able to actually have a monetary base that can be attached to this so that I can actually pay for that service. So I can actually pay for the filtering. I can pay for the compute to, you know, filter through all of this and find me the signal and the noise based on some set of semantic criteria. Like the architecture of the internet will change drastically, specifically because information is literally infinite now. And it is purely a element of time. And we now need, to the point that the internet will be unnavigable without a centralized platform that is filtering for us, or unless we create open filters. And the open filters, in my opinion, are social graph. Like you should, all of the reviews that you see on an Amazon product should never be the reviews that I see. Unless, well, we're in the same social graph. So actually, we would probably see a lot of the same reviews. But this should be weighted. Like, I should not see a 40-year-old soccer mom's review on a Bitcoin hardware wallet. Because that's not relevant to me. That's not
a hardcore Bitcoiner guy.
That's true. That's true. No, I can't be hating. But you get the idea of, like a great example, actually, is... and Alex Svetsky in the piece that I read on this called Reviewing Reviews, a really fantastic concept that they kind of uncovered, an issue that they uncovered that was actually bigger as they were building the Spirit of Satoshi model, the Bitcoin model. One of the examples that I thought was a fantastic example is that like Lord of the Rings, like there's all these like, not Lord of the Rings, what the Ring of Power, the Rings of Power of the new series is based on your political position. There's so many different like super antagonistic political things now where somebody will be like, oh, this is super woke. And then a whole bunch of people from the right will flood in and just give it 1-star reviews. And then somebody else will be like, they said that women should have babies. And everybody from the left comes, floods in and gives it a 1-star review. And nobody actually watched it. And then you go to the video and you've got like a 1-star review and you have no idea whether or not that's relevant to you. Well, imagine now that you're weighing things based on your social graph, and what actually propagates are reviews based on that social graph. Well, then if you're on the right, you're going to come in and you're going to see a 5-star because you're going to be ignoring all the liberal reviews. And then if you're a liberal and you go in, you're going to see 5-star because you're going to ignore all of the right reviews, or they're going to be weighted as lower because you're not just worried about clicks. You're not worried about numbers or, you know, what the rating of that person is on the platform based on the centralized company. You're worried about how close it is to your social graph. And because your social graph is right leaning or left leaning or Bitcoin leaning, whatever it is, you're going to see those reviews. The most important thing that you can do in order to secure your Bitcoin is to use a secure, trusted, long running hardware wallet in the Bitcoin space, and do one that is Bitcoin only, like the Cold Card. Not only do they have the Cold Card Mark IV, which is the cypherpunk calculator, but they also now have the Cold Card Q, which has the large screen, has a full QWERTY keyboard, has a flashlight, and a QR code scanner. It is the cypherpunk BlackBerry of the Cold Card series. And if you are looking to keep your Bitcoin safe and you want all of those advanced features, you want to do some custom setup with multi-sig, you want security features for those edge case scenarios where you need a brick me pin or a dummy pin that opens up to a fake wallet, the Cold Card has it all. And if you don't want to complicate your setup or you don't need any of those advanced features, you can use it simply as a secure default Bitcoin signing device. Keep your seed, keep your keys off of your desktop computer, off of your phone, and securely and easily use your Bitcoin. If you do not have a Cold Card, or you haven't even checked it out yet, go to coinkite.com. The link will be right in the show notes. And don't forget that when you are at your checkout, the code BITCOINAUDIBLE, all one word, will get you a discount. That will also be right in the show notes in case you forget about it. Keep your keys safe and get yourself a Cold Card.
Isn't the risk there that, you know, we just create more division and echo chambers, or we're all thinking, you know, basically feeding our own biases?
No, I think that's what we're doing now. I think like it's important for cultures to have competition, like
it's competing ideas.
It's a lack of communication and a lack of interaction, and people become more defensive and dig their heels in when they feel like they're not allowed to have the conversation. So when a left, the way that you make the right hate the left more, or vice versa, is by having the right on a left platform where they're not allowed to talk, or they're not allowed to say, oh, you're gay, or, you know, like they're not allowed to like do the, they're not allowed to live their culture, and then vice versa. Like when they feel like they're being choked, they lash out. When you can live separately, you can actually be friends with the other person. This is why freedom allows the competition of ideas. It's like, you go live your stupid crap and you can do whatever you want to do in your corner. I'll do whatever I want in my corner. And then we will compete and just see who succeeds, because there is culture that is relevant to life, that is aligned with the universe, and culture that is not aligned with the universe. And they will succeed or produce wealth based on that. Like if you think you're entitled to everything, and that other people are just supposed to give it to you, and that if you don't get it, you're just going to go out and attack somebody and steal it from them, you're not going to be successful. You're going to have a miserable life. You're going to be poor. And the only thing that you will ever, even if you ever achieve enormous amounts of power and you get a lot of people to install your system of entitlement on the world, you're just going to create an apocalypse. You're just going to destroy everything. If you are allowed to compete, well, then one person is poor for their culture and the other person is wealthy or happy or sustainable because of a competing culture that says, nobody owes me anything. I'm going to produce and I'm going to be responsible for my life. Very basic, very simple. You let those two people do their own thing. And that means that they should be able to see the world based on their values. And that's what something like this enables. And when they don't feel like they're being threatened, where they're being censored, then you don't have to be antagonistic to the other guy. You don't have to feel like you have to go stab the communist because the communists won't let you tweet to your friends. But when your platform is centralized and when your reviews are all one-star review because somebody said, you know, somebody said something that politically aligned with you instead of somebody that you don't even like, you know, that's how it got judged. Then you do feel like that communist is a threat to your existence. You do feel like you can't live and be free and be yourself unless you get them out of the way. And that's how you create hate, is you let someone force their worldview on another person. Centralized entities, centralized networks and platforms enable that action, like enable that level of control. A decentralized way to filter information based on your values is exactly how we live and let live. And it's exactly what we need to fix all of this crap, in my opinion.
Definitely an interesting idea. Like, you know, that when you see like the rise of Noster and, you know, these other so-called social graphs, you know, it seems like very early days.
But 100%. Yeah.
Very early days. But that's how the architecture of the internet's probably going to change. All these technologies merging together.
Yeah. It's all alpha software right now.
These are, you know, looking back, I mean, this conversation, you know, people be like, wow. But, you know, you talked about the privacy problem, so to speak. And, you know, there was the Samurai case, you know, a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, you said something to me that's like, you know, all perceived negative news in Bitcoin is actually defining and proving where the edges of control are and the limits of our new battleground. And I was wondering if maybe you could dig into that a little bit more, what you meant by it, how it relates to some of the latest developments.
Gotcha. Yeah. So a couple things is, this is also, I know we talked about this, have talked about this previously, but also I think I sent you a message about it, is the fact that politics is downstream from technology. Technology defines the environment, and then politics exists within the limits of that environment. And you know, a lot of, like, clearly everything that happened with Samurai Wallet is bad news. Like it's not good for Bitcoin in the short or medium term. It shows a vulnerability. Like, it shows where we are limited, because we have this explicit trade-off between the auditability of the chain and the privacy of the transactions that happen on them. But it is also important to remember that it is showing where the battle will take place, because this was the provision of a service from one person, like from one group to another group, is the ability to coin join these transactions together. It was a data service, right? Like, it wasn't a custodial service. It was a way to aggregate data among a bunch of people. But what is interesting about that is, like, so here's an example, is that, like, a lot of people can be like super defeatist about this, when it's important to remember that we're trying to figure out what this new landscape is and where the limitations of control are. And so we know, and I mean, we kind of always did, if you think about it, but that the service provision is the area where things are going to be attacked. But it is also a kind of a demonstration of the fact that this is where the battle will play out, because it can't happen at the monetary layer. It can't happen at the UTXO or public private key layer. So an example is, like, I was arguing, going back and forth with somebody on Noster who was saying that, like, oh, Bitcoin's controlled now, and you know, there's nothing we can do. They're going to KYC everything and all of this stuff. And when you think about it historically, from like kind of the sovereign individual thesis and the idea of the economics of violence, is that I think actually what we're showing is how much Bitcoin has moved us forward and where it has halted, like where we have reached the limit and what limit we need to tackle as we continue to build. Like what do we actually need to push through? How do we provide services without service providers, essentially? So an example of that is that, you know, I responded to this person, was, okay, you know, if they control Bitcoin, can you explain how exactly? Can you give me concrete details of what this control looks like? Because arresting the Samurai guys is not control of Bitcoin. It may be very inconvenient for Bitcoiners who want privacy. It may be like really bad news from the context, from a lot of different contexts for what we value and what we're trying to achieve, what we want available to everyone. But you know, where is the 21 millionth and first Bitcoin? Where who was not able to send their UTXO today? Who cannot access Bitcoin? You know, whose private key was revoked today? Which of Bitcoin's historical transactions were edited? You know, all of those things, like everything that Bitcoin does as far as solve and make this permanent, unstoppable monetary foundation and monetary good, remains exactly how it does. And in fact, it's showing that in order to stop this practice, they can't freeze accounts. They can't get into the network and shut down their access. They have to go and arrest the actual people, which is exactly what the economics of violence suggest is necessary to get us to the next wave. Right now, we have a system where they can defraud the system in an unlimited fashion to... This is how they get away with the scope. So, you know, if somebody's providing a service that they don't like, they don't have to go attack them. They just go ahead and freeze the account in the fiat land. If somebody is, you know, if they need to confiscate another $1 trillion in wealth, they just spend $1 trillion in wealth. They don't have to go tax it from anybody. And people don't realize how psychotic the scope of what the fiat system is stealing from us, because we are so productive, because we have so much technological advantage. But you know, people like compare it to GDP. Oh, what the government, what the US government spends is only like, I don't know, 15% or something of GDP, whatever it is, like $6 trillion in GDP is like 30, you know?
Yeah, so it jumped up to like a double digits during the pandemic.
Like, and that seems, that even seems crazy, but GDP is a bullshit metric. It has nothing to do with anything. If you spend $6 trillion into the banks and those banks loan out that $6 trillion, that's $12 trillion of GDP. It's still all them. It's still like the banks aren't like suddenly make it free market money because they got $6 trillion counterfeit dollars. And so like, you know, you have to get like 20 steps removed to even pretend that this is somehow removed from their influence. What you do is you compare it to the actual earnings of society. And the, so like the median income of a US citizen is, I think it's like 40 to 42, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know. I looked it up like a bunch of different times and it's like different for every year. I believe it's somewhere in the 40s, but I did the calculation. The most recent calculation was that, and only 166 million people in this country are actually in the workforce. So a full half of this country is just living off of what the other half produces. And, you know, obviously that's kids, old people, like, you know, all of that stuff. And the government prints, the government budget is like $6.2 trillion now. If you take the average income and multiply it by the number of people who are working, it's only about $6 trillion. In fact, it's a little bit less. The government is more than half of the economy. They control everything. You would never get away with a 60% tax on everybody. Mm-hmm. What this new battleground is showing is that in the Bitcoin world, within the Bitcoin environment, they're going to have to samurai wallet every one of us to get that money, which means it's not going to work.
It's not enforceable.
There's either going to be a revolution or society becomes, goes from a quiet fraud of 60% of our wealth to guns and whips stealing 60% of our wealth. That one is not, that second one is not sustainable. It simply isn't. It will be awful, and they will be the awful, shitty, horrific people that they are, and they will try to go there. But there will be a revolution before we get there. It's not, it doesn't work unless the whole system's a fraud. And as bad news, a bad news item or event as seeing people that I believe are completely innocent and have done nothing wrong, having to fight the government, who are in a cage, because of a service that they have provided to me, to other, to people that I know, that I care about. To see them attacked is also showing that they have to be attacked to stop it. It's showing the limits of where our battleground is, and it's also showing exactly what we need to fix. Okay, how do we do this without them? How do we make sure that we don't need to have those people in this arrangement? So it switches from a game of defraud the entire system and everybody in it quietly, and where 98% of the people aren't even aware and they will defend it. It's like, oh no, it's only 20% of GDP. It's like, bitch, it's half of your wealth. When we move from that system to one where everything has to be directly stolen and taxed, because they can't just spend a trillion Bitcoin. They can't just spend a million Bitcoin that they don't have. As we shift more and more toward that, it's showing that the economics of violence have completely changed. And from the foundation of actually establishing that money and establishing that immutable ledger, we can solve this. Those other things are just technological problems. They're software problems. And we can sort that crap out. But the battleground has completely changed. And I think it's showing where that edge is.
Yeah.
So to speak.
I think it's not all doom and gloom. I think, you know, it just, like you said, it kind of shows us where we need to build and build more decentralized tools. And there was a little bit of a centralized coordinator there with Samurai Wallet. And for some reason, they're saying that them collecting that fee, they were doing it for profit, and that's unlawful because of the illicit activity. You know, that's the battleground that they're saying, that the justification. And so now, you know, there's already a push for experimentation. There was like joint markets, which didn't really get that much attention, but now it has more attention. There was, you know, there's silent payments. There's other solutions that are gaining more attention, more eyeballs, you know, more fingers coding in those solutions now that some of these actions have taken place. So I think it's not all doom and gloom. There is, like, you know, a silver lining, I guess you could say.
Yeah, no, I agree. And in fact, there's something in a post by Lola Leitz, actually, I thought was just an interesting way to think about it, is that we need a second mempool. We need a different way to send around transactions in a more private way at the base layer to basically begin to help this. Not only do I agree, but, you know, it gives us that focus of like, okay, what do we need to build to target it? I think people also hugely underestimate the potential of things like Nostr, the Pear Stack, and AI to actually make Bitcoin vastly more secure and vastly more private, because the infrastructure, a lot of the limitations, a lot of the trade-offs of Bitcoin are actually built on the communication layers that Bitcoin runs on. You know,
Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, the privacy implications of, you know, being able to do analysis on the network and see where transactions come in from. The ability to ensure that you can get across a firewall because you're using normal ISP server client model. The fact that you can have a fully validating node, but you can't have a listening node, one that will actually fulfill requests unless you're hosting on a ClearNet server. Like, you have to have port forwarding on your firewall at home. Most people don't have that. They just got their start nine or running on a normal computer. So they're not taking requests from the network. So they can't be the node for their friends and family. But if you have a peer-to-peer architecture, if you can DM somebody an encrypted transaction to broadcast from anywhere. In fact, why would you ever need to broadcast from your machine if you can have a blinded group of people that are just randomly grabbing and broadcasting a bunch of transactions all at once that are just delayed every, you know, happens once every 24 hours or something? Like, the infrastructure itself, the Bitcoin is only as secure as the, this is why you build a satellite network. This is why Blockstream builds satellite network to propagate Bitcoin blocks, right? So that you can get to it without the internet, because the Bitcoin is only as secure as its communication layer. The internet goes down, Bitcoin goes down. If you have a satellite network, not so much. So when you build tools and new protocols like Nostr to have encrypted conversations, when you build new things like the Pear Stack to have peer-to-peer service provision and the ability to get around this port forwarding thing, the idea of like providing a service now it's so unbelievably simple. And I just don't, people are just so greatly missing how valuable this is. And I think a lot of people are just like, oh, Qt's not open source yet. And it's like, ignore Qt. Look at the Pear runtime environment. Like, I can make an app. I can make a micro app right now with AI and like a really short, simple thing and deliver it to my brother anywhere, and he can run it on his machine in a matter of seconds. I have done this in a matter of seconds. You just connect directly to the other person and they get it with a key. I have Wholesale, which it's brand new. It's actually going to be what we're doing the second episode of the Pear Report about. Is basically Tailscale peer-to-peer with no GitHub account, no central server connecting you. If Tailscale goes down, you don't have to worry about not being able to rebuild your VPN tunnel between your two devices. And he actually sent me a message today. He was like, I just got it working on iOS and Android. I was like, hell yes. But I have AI running on my Linux machine, but I don't have that processor. I don't have that freaking GPU. The GPU is bigger than my laptop, for crying out loud. So I don't have it on my laptop. I can't run that stuff on this nearly as I can run it on this machine. But I just have like a Wholesale key, and I just be like, okay, well, I have a local service. And I punch the info of that local service into the thing. And I just say, I can't remember the command. It's like send or deliver. I can't remember. It just generates a key. And this is a terminal command. So he's got a desktop app that's going to be coming very soon. In fact, it'll probably hit before the episode publishes. But like, it's like one command. It's like so simple. And then I take that key and I punch it in on this computer, and then I can just log into it like a website. Mm-hmm. And I did it from the airport, from my computer at home. And I'm like running generative AI stuff to make like image stuff for the next episode to be published from the airport. And I'm showing it off to my brother or whatever. And I don't have port forwarding. I didn't set anything up. I didn't run a server. I didn't get a domain name. I didn't do any of that shit. I literally started up a thing, got a key on my computer, and then I'm running it on my MacBook and I can run it from anywhere. And this sort of thing is going to so vastly simplify the interaction. Like, just imagine the world of just being able to connect to any service or any device with a QR code. And that's it. That's all. You just scan a QR code and then you are connected. You want to share something, you share a file, boom, you're connected. You want to share a service, you're connected. You want to get some Bitcoin node information, you're connected. You want to coin join with them, you're connected. Mm-hmm. Is there a third party? No. Is there a central coordinator? No. Is it encrypted? Yes. You the entire thing, like when you change the fundamental nature of the communication layer and the ability to communicate, and it's ClearNet speeds. It's like Nostr Wallet Connect is another example. It bridges it through relays, but it's completely open, so you can just like constantly swap out the relays. But it's like one of those things, like that's kind of the same concept. Is it, you know, how do you connect straight to your wallet without any of the headache of going over Tor and the awful latency? Like, I love the fact that Tor is a private network that we can use. I love my Start 9, but I'll tell you what, using a wallet, a remote Lightning wallet over Tor is a pain in the ass. I hate waiting 6 seconds, 20 seconds for a payment to go through. And it's not even because the Lightning network is slow. It's because I'm communicating back and forth like four different times between a couple of different devices to do this handshake for the Lightning payment. And it's all over Tor, and everything's got like 500 millisecond lag at each stage of the thing because it's Tor. And that's why people don't do it, because it's just easier to use Phoenix.
Convenience and UX and UI.
Yeah. But when you solve that problem, you fundamentally change all of the frustrations and the dynamics and the headache of just being like, run your own node and connect to your own node. Right now, that's a ridiculous statement for 99% of people. It can be made easy. It can be made easy, and we have those tools. But a lot of those tools are still fresh because it's us thinking about the way that we need to change the communication networks to make all of this stuff reliable. And that's one thing I've talked about. God, I talked about this 12 years ago in Bitcoin, is the idea that Bitcoin's rise is actually going to create more incentive, more philosophical backing and understanding. It's going to increase, it's going to explode the culture of cypherpunk, just basically make it into the mainstream. People are going to understand what the word cypherpunk means and the fact that there are people who care about privacy and encryption and sovereignty. And then the unbelievable amount of capital that it will make available to those people, to that philosophy and to that culture, to keep solving our problems. We have never, never in the history of the world had a culture that is this strong, an understanding of those values. The cryptography mailing list was like a few hundred people, like maybe 1,000 people or something. And they were all completely unheard of. Nobody had ever heard the word. The idea of anybody knowing who they were was insane. Like, it just was not common knowledge, even in the slightest. Today, that is different. Today, government money is called fiat. Everybody calls it that. It is called fiat. That is crazy. That is a massive mind shift.
Even.
Right? Right? And the only reason that I'm able to build what I'm able to, what I'm doing with Pair Runtime, which I'm not a developer, but I've hired two developers to do this, is because of Bitcoin. I'm able to build what I want because I don't have to go get financing from somebody. I can just take the risk. I can just be like, okay, I want to solve my problem my way. And I can do that. I'm a tiny microcosm of everything that is going on in this space, that we're able to actually chase what we want to see. And what's crazy is that this is literally what sound money does. It's just on steroids. It's just like doing a line of cocaine when you're talking about it during the monetization phase, because it's an exponent on everything. And it just, I don't know. I think we are in a better position than we have ever been before to actually solve these problems. And I think we actually have the tools to do it. And I think being pessimistic now, just because the rocks got thrown at us that we knew were going to get thrown at us, and you know, we're just starting, like, it's all going to get worse, but we still have all of the capability to actually accomplish it. Like, the prices that we will pay to get to where we want will be vastly smaller than the prices that the people paid before us to get to where we are. And I think to be pessimistic now is just crazy. Like, it's just pessimism for the sake of pessimism. Like, I'm wildly optimistic. The technological landscape is changing aggressively, and politics will bow to that. Politics does not trump technology. It just doesn't. This is the Swan Bitcoin app, and this is how easy it is to just buy Bitcoin whenever you're feeling like it. And I feel like it right now. And as it shows me right here, I still have $9,388 worth of my $10,000 of Bitcoin buying that has no fees whatsoever. And now I have $10 more worth of Bitcoin. I do this quite often. One of the really great things about Swan is the incredible number of resources they have for learning and understanding anything that you want to know about Bitcoin. And importantly, they're going to teach you why you should not trade. They're not going to encourage you to trade. They are Bitcoin only. If you're looking for an easy and reliable way to get into Bitcoin, if you're looking to put Bitcoin in your IRA, if you're looking to put Bitcoin in your business, if you're looking to do anything around getting on a Bitcoin standard or getting exposed to Bitcoin in your portfolio, check out swanbitcoin.com/guy is my special link, and you will find it very conveniently right in the show notes.
Well, we did. We saw signs of politicians kind of bowing a little bit to, I mean, I could say the broader crypto industry, I guess, but with the SAB 121 being overturned, and now Trump coming out saying, I mean, now it's like becoming this political hot campaign issue.
It's great. This is great. Mean, I love it. Wild, fight.
But fight, like, bitches. it's just pretty wild, because, you know, you wouldn't even think about that 5 years ago. It just shows how strong Bitcoin has grown over time, that Bitcoin is winning, that you have the two leading presidential candidates basically taking stances, you know, one way or another on Bitcoin. It shows that, like, you know, politics is downstream of technology, because I saw a statistic that like 20% of US adults own some form of cryptocurrency, which probably a majority of that is Bitcoin, if you just think through that. That's wild.
That's crazy.
Fifth of US adults.
Yeah. You
know, that's
some of them don't even know they're exposed to it. That's another thing that's like really crazy, is that there are people who, there are companies now that are exposed to it because of the companies they're exposed to have bought it. You know,
index funds and mutual funds.
Yeah, yeah. The hedge funds, I think it was like 50% now of like the top 100 hedge funds are directly exposed in some way to the movement of Bitcoin. And that changed very quickly. And it's just because of the ETFs. And you know, Vanguard, you know, new CEO, I think it was, is it the new CEO of Vanguard, or do I have that right?
The new CEO who's succeeding the old one, like in the fall, is the ex BlackRock lead ETF guy.
That's right. That's right. Yes. Yes. Which is an indication of where that might go, I feel like.
Potentially.
But I think this is a lot of us winning just with the steps back that we kind of knew. You know, it's not like any of this was like not part of the discussion. We've been talking about this for years, that this is where and how they're going to hit us. It'll be KYC. It'll be the exchanges. It'll be service provision. And that's where we will have to fight the battle. And Super Tesnet created MSB, or MSB, and I'm not sure exactly how to say it. Basically, like within, you know, a day or two, and essentially in response to the whole Samurai wallet situation, which basically uses Nostr as a blinded public board to coin join with. So it's like you can't shut it down, and there's no real coordinator. It's just a bunch of blind relays. You're doing it basically with like a bunch of group DMs in a sense. And so, it's not that we can't build these things. It's that we haven't had the incentive or the need to. Honestly, we've had a pretty easy run. Like, we haven't had a lot of challenges. Everybody's like, "Ah, it's hard." And then, no, it's not. Like, just the price goes down a little bit sometimes, and then it comes back up. Like, it's been really easy going. Nobody has really attacked us. Like, it's been pretty chill. In fact, everything after 2013 and 2014 was, God, those 2014, 15 years were murder. Like, it was just like blood everywhere. Like, all this, everything that was like a major service in Bitcoin, I feel like just vanished. Like, if there was a time to think that Bitcoin was dead and there was no coming back, it was that. It was straight up 2014 and 2015. Like, I was a mess. It's been pretty easy since then. It's been basically a whole string of good news with the expected bad news sprinkled in.
Yeah, that's optimism, man. I love that. It has, though. I mean, like, I know what you're saying. I mean, there hasn't really been direct attacks, or I mean, the one that I could think of is maybe the China attack on mining, but that was good for Bitcoin in the long
run. Yeah. No, it's fantastic. And it just shows, probably, if you know, the US tries the same thing or tries a similar thing, is that they'll need to go a different route because of how completely ineffective what China did was, you know? And like, because if they just ban it, they're just going to leave and or mine underground. And it took like 5-6 months to completely recover. Like, that whole thing was just wild. Like, half of the network hash power picked up, unplugged, picked up shop, shipped somewhere else, sat back down, plugged back in. And in 6 months, the entire thing was, thing was out in the wash. Like, it was just done.
Crazy.
And it's wild. And there was I had no idea. Like, if you didn't know that it was happening, you never would have had a clue. Never, like, blocks still coming in, Lightning transactions work, nothing changed. Like, you can't do that with any other service or any other, like, in the context of like a giant mountain in the middle of an ocean. Like, it remained that mountain. Like, nothing changed. It was still there. It was still available for everyone. That was just wild. So crazy.
Yeah, that was a piece of FUD. You know, China is going to ban Bitcoin or mining, or, you know,
go ahead.
Like, that's gone. You know, Bitcoin's stronger. That was like a big FUD piece. That was very common to hear from critics. Mm-hmm. And now you don't hear it too much anymore, obviously. Yeah, no, I think there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic. I think one of the things I like to follow you for is, you know, it seems like you have your finger on the pulse of new developments. And you brought up Hedgehog, which I thought was really interesting, because one of the issues with Lightning right now is it still can be kind of hard to use, I would say, for the normie user. I think that's a fair statement. I mean, in a sovereign way, let's say. I mean, you can use Lightning really easily if you're using like a custodial wallet for sure. But tell us about Hedgehog a little bit.
Okay. So I actually think one of the big drawbacks is the symmetry of Lightning payments, of updating Lightning payments. And when you're, you know, running your own node, and if, especially if you don't want to be a router, you still have to be online to sign the payment to actually know you got it. Because you send the you sign the revocation and send it back to the sender. So there's like a two-way thing, and there's essentially four steps of signing and exchanging different pieces of a signed transaction in order to know that it's actually secure and final. Whereas that's a huge limitation, right? Is that, you know, if you've ever tried to send it to a Lightning wallet that was non-custodial, you'll notice exactly how big of a pain it is. Unless you have your wallet out and you scan and send or receive the payment and the other person has their wallet open, it actually doesn't work. If you cut your wallet off and you put it in your pocket or something, they won't be able to send you the payment. You have to be there to receive it. Mm-hmm. That is a massive limitation, and there's not easy ways around it. There's been like a bunch of like hacky ways around it, but generally like the easy way around it is use a custodian. Which also isn't like the end of the world. Like you can manage exactly how your degree of risk, you know, like people like to think they're like, oh, it's sovereignty and not your keys, not your coins and all this stuff. And it's like, which is 1,000% true when you talk about it as a general philosophy. But to think that there's no difference between risking $100,000 in an exchange or $2 in a custodial wallet is ridiculous. Like, I don't care if I'm happy to risk, you know, $5 worth of value in a custodial Lightning wallet and then just withdraw every day or two to my wallet if I can't get a Lightning address. But it does mean that I'm reliant on them for the fulfillment of payment. So they're like, you know, like, let's say they try to censor me and they steal my $5 or $10, whatever it is. And which is just like, you son of a bitch. And I get on with my life. But if they take down my Lightning address, now people can't zap me on Noster. So I have to scramble to find a new solution, right? So I'm still dependent on them for the service, for the access. And we want that self-hosted. This is where the various solutions, the various new ideas in the Lightning network come. But most of them, like L2, like L-Enhance, require a soft fork. They require fundamental changes to the network itself in order to accomplish those benefits of asymmetric payments, where somebody can just push it to you and you can be offline, where you don't need a Lightning address. You can do a key, you can pay to public key, like that sort of thing. But Super Testnet has built something which is actually takes a concept that was developed for Arc by Burak, called a connector. And interestingly, what this does is it's actually kind of like a pseudo covenant, but there's no soft fork. There's no fundamental, you can do this right now. In fact, he's built it and he was just showing it to me this morning. Actually, I was talking to him a little while ago. He showed it to me that he built it on his little testnet that he just did. And you can send payments and you can send the payment as just a data blob. And whereas normal Lightning has four different steps and it requires handshakes in both ways and then sending transactions both ways, this is a purely push. This is purely like, if Alice is trying to pay Bob, Alice creates the transaction and then creates the revocation transaction and the details necessary to submit that revoking, you know, like basically submit the enforcement of that update. And then she just sends it to Bob. And obviously you can do this over the Lightning network. This is what you do when you route a payment normally. Or you can send all of that information, and if Bob's offline, you can just shoot him an email. And then 30 minutes later, he can come back online and he just copies that or clicks it, let's say it's a link, you can format it some formal way that a wallet can recognize, okay, this is important information for me, this is a payment, and just take that and you put it in your wallet, and now boom, you've settled the transaction, and you do it completely
offline. You can do it
entirely offline.
They don't have to both be online. They can basically send an email or text message. Once Bob gets back to his computer, reads the email, he can just accept it, and then it settles.
Yes. So
that's like...
That is a huge fundamental shift.
Synchronous payments on Lightning, essentially.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the most important things to solve to make self-hosting not a nightmare.
Yeah.
Like, not frustrating. But one of the other really cool things is there's like a couple of additional benefits to this just because of how it accomplishes it. Is it's not simply that you get offline payments now. It's also that payments that are stuck that you want to hold in route aren't toxic anymore. Because one of the things about Lightning is that everything has a relative and an absolute time lock when you're routing transactions through. If everybody is using Hedgehog, if everybody has this new using the connector as opposed to the old enforcement mechanism, is you actually don't need the relative and the absolute time lock. You only need the relative time lock, which means that enforcement is only necessary or only relevant when something gets submitted to the chain. Because the time lock doesn't start until somebody's trying to enforce something, which means that you can sit on it. Like, so Mutiny did a bunch of stuff with the HODL HTLCs to try to make it so you could send somebody payments online on Lightning offline, but it ended up creating a ton of like unnecessary force closures, and then a whole bunch of nodes started being like, we don't accept these types of payments, and it became like a huge headache because every single time a payment goes through, if it doesn't get settled immediately, there's a time decay. It's like an options contract.
It withers away.
Yeah, like if it gets closer to the expiration, you have to force close or you just lose it. But when you only use the relative time lock and you have this one-way connector, this asymmetric payment, is that you can just chill. So if you're on the hook for 1,000 sat routed and the person's not back online, you just lose 1,000 sats. And in fact, if you recognize that this is a payment that doesn't go through immediately, you can just charge a slightly higher fee for having to sit around and wait for it. But if it takes 2 days for them to come back, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Time lock doesn't kick in until someone tries to enforce it.
Yeah. That's great. So
it makes the Lightning network a lot more fluid and a lot less kind of on the edge of something going wrong. You know, like, because like all these expirations and stuff of like payments in flow, like, really causes data that doesn't move, that doesn't like really get settled instantly, to be toxic. The more of that stuff you're holding, the worse it is. Whereas in this scenario, not only is it just that the user can just come on and just redeem the payment whenever they want to with the essentially an eCash token in a sense, like, it just the details itself are the payment. But if it wants to be held in route, it can, and it doesn't really cost anything except for the sats being held in route, you know? So like, okay, maybe it is a problem if it's a million sats, but if it's 1,000 sats, it's literally a 1,000 sat problem, which is a small problem. But then the other really cool thing, which I didn't even think about until today, because he was talking about like a couple of the other things he was building with it, is that this means that you can actually open channels and push payments to people while they are offline.
Oh.
Which means that you can actually have, like, so Swan is a great example, right? Is I have my automatic payment out every month. I think it's like a 500,000 sats or something like that. And when it's pushed to me, it just has to go to an address because I'm offline. Right? Like if I'm not there to receive and sign my end of Lightning payment, well, then I can't receive it over Lightning. And recurring payments are a pain in the butt over Lightning specifically because of that reason. We don't have subscriptions. We can't do really that sort of stuff. But if you can actually unilaterally open a Lightning channel with me and push the payment, and I don't have to be there and I don't have to sign anything to even set up the channel, and you can email me the payment and I can just get it whenever. Well, why would any payment to my cold card, to my hardware wallet, not also be a Lightning channel? Why not? And now my nunchuck and like my tap signer and like when I'm doing like my cold card, like I'm doing my normal hardware wallet setup to my phone, why wouldn't they all be Lightning payments? Why wouldn't I just do Lightning straight off my hardware wallet? Why would I need ever be anything channel if you now can just do it unilaterally? You can send to an open Lightning channel. All of this is soft fork free. All of this is just a different way to build the Lightning interaction. And
right on. Like,
yeah, I think this is a massive
hedgehog, thing. Basically. I can tell you're pumped about it.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, if you get pumped about something, I mean, it's usually noteworthy. check out Hedgehog if you're listening to that. I mean, it gets me bullish just to hear. I think people just forget that, you know, Bitcoin and Lightning, you know, these are protocols, and there's just people building on them. And they're gonna come up with things in the future that nobody could think about today. And maybe Hedgehog is this major breakthrough. I mean, that has all this potential. Like, we'll see over time with adoption. And, you know, it's just, it didn't exist, you know, last year. you know what I mean? It's just exciting to see the development happening. Last thing I just want to ask you, like, before we go, we kind of got to close up here, but it's Bitcoin Pizza Day.
So oh, happy. Yes, happy it
Bitcoin
is.
Pizza Day, man. Yeah.
Bitcoin Pizza Day, baby. I got to order my pizza.
Yeah, I saw Bitstein. Bitstein cracks me up. He was like, you know, back then it cost 10,000 pizza or 10,000 Bitcoin for two pizzas. And he's like, today, 10,000 Bitcoin buys 40% of Papa John's. I was like, that's amazing. But any quick thoughts on Bitcoin Pizza Day? You know, what it means to you? Are you going to celebrate tonight?
Yeah, I eat pizza. Yeah, I eat pizza. That's what Bitcoin Pizza Day means to me. As someone who tries to eat steak, bacon, and eggs and all of that stuff and tries to avoid the pizza stuff, I love when Pizza Day comes around because I can buy some pizza. And it's my sister, actually, who does the graphics and design and everything for Bitcoin Audible, actually, or all my shows, made me for Christmas a couple of years ago, made me a really cool backdrop things. They're like, it's 9 different things of like different Bitcoin holidays, like Shitcoin Day and Pizza Day or whatever, and it's lovely. So I always know when it is because I've got my big artwork and then like the May 22nd, 2010 Bitcoin Pizza Day. And it's up in our living room right now. Like,
nice.
And it doesn't look like a big Bitcoin display. You have to like kind of like really look at it. You're like, oh shit, this is all like cool Bitcoin stuff. But I love it because I know all my days. Nice. But yeah,
well, enjoy the pizza, man.
I will very much so. Thank you.
Enjoy the pizza. Thanks for coming on Swan Signal. I appreciate it. Where can people find you to learn more about your work and follow you along in case they don't know you?
Yeah, for sure. And I want to make one comment about something you said, is that, like, you know, people are building for this. Is we cannot discount it. We got to remember how vastly different the landscape is today. Is that one of the most important things about Bitcoin is that it is permissionless. Anybody and everybody can and is building on it. And whenever we have a problem, we still don't have to go get a banking license to solve it. We still don't have to go get a Fed account to solve it. Like, look at the problems that Custodia is having trying to get a Federal Reserve license and account to actually provide some sort of a banking service. We don't have that in Bitcoin. They have that in traditional banking. And that is the most, as long as the network is permissionless, I think there is nothing we can't solve. It's just a matter of time, energy, and how much we care. And if you want to check out my stuff, I just started a new show, actually, the Pair Report, which is actually going to it's going to be a sub Bitcoin Audible show, so you can check out Bitcoin Audible, AI Unchained. AI Unchained is weekly, Bitcoin Audible is 3 days a week at least, and then Shitcoin Insider, which is not dead. I haven't done a show for a really long time, but I've actually got one in the works. So I've got the 4 podcasts And a lot of media and stuff that we're getting into. I've expanded the team a lot this year. So you can check me out on Noster, on X, on YouTube, and Rumble. We have a lot of stuff on the way and a lot of fun little videos that everybody seems to be enjoying. And I'm going to have those coming out like probably every week now. So lots of cool stuff. Team's a lot bigger and a lot more streamlined than it has been. And I'm stoked.
Nice, man. Well, definitely recommend it if people haven't followed Bitcoin Audible or your other shows. I love them. Just been doing it for a while. I've been listening for a while. So thanks for coming on the show. What you just said too, I think is so important in terms of the permissionlessness. It just reminds me of the F.A. Hayek quote. I mean, you brought him up earlier. Just finding a sly roundabout way to create a new system, right? And I think that's
something they can't stop,
right? So. Yeah. Thanks for coming on. Appreciate it, guy.
Oh, yeah, man.
My friend. I'll see you on the internet, on the internets, and
that's good.
Or maybe in person sometime soon.
Yeah, probably pretty soon.
Yeah. All right, man. Have a good one.